Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. Tonight, author Peter Pomerantsev has spent a lot of time looking into modern propaganda, but for his latest book, he rolls back the years to the Second World War. Sefton Delmer ran propaganda operations for Britain and had a keen understanding of how it worked and how to counteract the Nazi propaganda. And in How to Win an Information War, Pomerantsev looks at how that knowledge translates to now and could be beneficial. The U.S. state of Oregon decriminalized possession of small amounts of hard drugs just 3.5 years ago. It was seen as a radical move. A lot of people were watching to see how it would work out. And now it's so unpopular that it's being reversed. So where did it all go so wrong? And what lessons are there for other jurisdictions, including Canada? The kids, it turns out, are not all right these days, at least according to the World Happiness Report out today. It shows that while Canada ranks 15th out of 143 countries, under 30s are far gloomier, positioning Canada at 56th. And it's a trend seen in the US, Japan, and Western European countries as well. So what is going on? The report's editor, a Canadian, joins me to explain. But first, the hockey world and beyond are paying tribute to Chris Simon today. The longtime NHL tough guy died Monday at the age of 52. His family says he took his own life and believe that chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, played a significant role in his struggles and in his suicide. Longtime NHL tough guy Chris Nyland joins me to talk about Simon and the struggles that many hockey enforcers seem to face after retirement. Let's begin tonight with the hockey world and far beyond, paying tribute today to Chris Simon, the 1990 first round draft pick and one of the NHL's most feared tough guys of his era, died Monday at the age of 52. At 6'3" and 232 pounds, the Wawa, Ontario born Simon cut an intimidating figure during his 782 games across 15 seasons in the NHL beginning back in 1992. He was born to an Ojibwe father and an Anglo-Saxon mom in the tiny town of Wawa, Ontario. He racked up more than 1,800 minutes in penalties, including more than 100 fights during his time with the Nordiques, Avalanche, Capitals, Blackhawks, Rangers, Flames, Islanders, and Wild. He won a cup in Colorado. He was a two-time All-Star. The NHL Players Association confirmed the news via Simon's family that he had died Monday night. Today, his family said that he had taken his own life, and they believe that a traumatic or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, played a significant factor in his suicide. CTE, as you may know, often talked about in relation to professional football, but also with hockey, is associated with repeated traumatic brain injuries, including concussions and continued headshots. Deaths by suicide and drug overdose are common among athletes in CTE cases. A statement from the family read, "The family strongly believes and witnessed firsthand that Chris struggled immensely from CTE, which unfortunately resulted in his death. We are grieving with the loss of our son, brother, father, partner, teammate, and friend. The entire Wawa community is sharing in our grief. We appreciate everyone who shares in our tragic loss." Now, the NHL has repeatedly disputed any links between hockey and CTE. Commissioner Gary Bettman was asked about Chris Simon's death today.
Chris's passing is tragic. It's sad. We extend our deepest condolences to his family and friends. And, you know, on all these matters, we wait to see what the medical experts tell us. However, having said that, I think it's well documented all the progress that we've made over the last couple of decades to make the game as safe as possible.
Gary Bettman there, the NHL commissioner. But Simon's death, of course, follows the deaths of other enforcers, such as Derek Bougard, Rick Rippon, Wade Bielak, and Bob Probert. Probert and Bougard were both confirmed to have CTE following their deaths. And a study of former NHLers by researchers at Columbia in New York published last year found enforcers died on average a decade younger than comparable peers. It defined enforcer fighters as players who had participated in 50 or more career fights and compared them to similar players who had not. Joining me now is Chris Nyland. He played 688 NHL regular season games for the Canadiens, Bruins, and Rangers between 1980 and 1992. He won the Cup in 86 as a Hab, and he's a longtime broadcaster, now co-host of the Raw Knuckles podcast. Chris, thanks for your time tonight.
Hey, no problem, Ben. Good to join you.
I guess just your reaction to Chris Simon's death.
Well, I'd like to say shocking and really sad that this man had to take such drastic measures in his life to end his life, and you wonder where somebody or how somebody gets like that. And there's certainly a lot of question marks. I'm sure some of those will be answered maybe at some point, but it's just so sad, and it's just a terrible thing.
Yeah, he was. I mean, you must remember watching him play because he reminded me a bit of, honestly, a bit of you, hard knuckles, soft hands in a way.
Yeah, he could play. There's no question. He could play the game. Fearless competitor. He stuck up for his teammates. He did his job. I got to meet him in Los Angeles around 2002, I think it was, with a group of guys that were working out there. And I found him to be a really nice guy who certainly had some struggles, but a good man, good person.
Yeah. I mean, the family today has come out and sort of spoke about the struggles that he was having. He was, it certainly had some issues that not alone amongst those who had been considered enforcers in the NHL over so many years. We've seen other stories such as this one, stories I know you're intimately familiar with, but certainly he had some struggles and it does paint a bigger picture. There'll be a lot of people talking about yet another, NHL tough guy whose life has ended very young.
Yeah, well, it's sad, and I know that group of players, the enforcers, the guys who did that job. There was a study done that, right? They generally, other athletes in hockey live 10 years longer than they do. I know he tried to get sober, right? He was sober for a bit. He tried to turn his life around. You have to look at the life of each player and that whole life, and how they grew up. Their early formative years, their teenage years, and then their time in the National Hockey League and their time after, and what goes on in their lives. So it happens to be that fighters, some of them certainly have passed too early. There's no question about it. What is the reason for that?
Yeah. I mean, I know you associate with this. I mean, what was part of the thing that's come up a lot is just sort of the pain of the physical pain of after that kind of a career in sport. I mean, it's not the only hockey players or not the only athletes to sort of have pain and injury after the fact, but certainly in Chris Simon's case, there was talk about how he had struggled with addiction, but also just struggled with the aftermath, the physical toll that had taken on him over those years.
Yeah, listen, I deal with the same stuff. I've had a slew of surgeries. I've had over 30 surgeries on my body. I have a new knee now. I've had my ankle 5 times. I had it fused. My hands, my shoulders. So I wanted to play in the National Hockey League, and I accepted and thrived at the role that I performed every night for the team I played for. I was passionate about it. Yeah, it's a tough role to perform, and there's can be repercussions from that, whether they're physical, mental, or emotional.
Do you think there are enough, and I don't know this, but do you think there are enough supports after you get out of the game? I know back when you retired and probably when Chris Simon retired as well, this wasn't a conversation that was going on out there about sort of mental health and what was happening afterwards and so on. But was there enough support? I mean, loving the role and being great at the role is obvious, but afterwards, is there anywhere you could reach out to and sort of say, listen, I'm struggling here?
Listen, I struggle with more the transition out of hockey, not the fighting and the injuries and all that stuff. Yeah, my body hurt and all that, and all those surgeries I had after my career. Certainly, the league didn't pay for any of those surgeries. You miss the game, you miss the locker room. I think that is what guys, sure, you miss the competition, but if you play long enough and it wears on you, it gets tougher as you get older. I was 34 years old. It was tough at the end. All these young kids coming in, wanting to challenge you, just getting up every day and doing that job. And I did it to the end, but it got really difficult. And that transition out is also difficult if you're not prepared for it. You can have all the money in the world. And yeah, that could make the transition easier. But still, if you don't get into something else right away and get your life going in another direction, you're going to struggle. And I can certainly attest to that because I did. And athletes will never, never find that one thing that will replace that one big thing they're missing about the game, that big emptiness they have when they leave the game. I was addicted to painkillers. My life took a terrible turn. I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not ashamed to say it. happened to me. It was part of my life. And the league put me in treatment twice, which I'm so grateful for, because I could have never afforded the treatment that I went to.
Longtime NHL tough guy Chris Nyland is with me this half hour to talk about the death of fellow enforcer Chris Simon. His family says the 52-year-old from Wawa, Ontario, took his own life on Monday. His loved ones believe chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, that's repeated brain injuries, played a significant factor in his suicide. Chris, I know that CTE is something that you know a whole lot about.
Yeah, you do, and I do. And, you know, I know his family said he had CTE. You know, from what I've heard, some of the attributes are anger, short fuse, headaches, depression, those things. Now, if he was suffering from that, then very well it could be CTE. And, you know, I would hope that his family would donate his brain to Boston University Medical Center, who's doing a concussion study and trying to figure this thing out before it's too late for some guys. Bob Probert's wife, Danny, donated his brain. She's the one who kind of prodded me and pushed me to get into that program, which I did. I became part of that study, and I actually have to go back in the next month for my yearly testing. And I'm glad I did it, because, you know, and I've donated my brain when I pass on to that program. So hopefully down the road, there's ways to detect it early and maybe help some guys.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a large, long article in the New York Times that featured that you were featured in, right about that whole process you went through. And it was interesting you talking about wanting to continue to sort of be there for your teammates, that you felt this was something that you should do for the people you played with all those years.
Well, yeah, listen, I think in general, for sports in general, not just hockey, all of sports, you know, when you talk about American football, talk about boxing, you talk about soccer, hitting the ball off your head. I mean, what is a concussion? Anytime your brain moves inside your cranium, when you get hit off the boards and your head shakes, when you get punched in the head, when you get elbowed in the head, when you get a shoulder to the jaw and you see the Tweety birds, that's not a fun thing, but it happens. Once I got hit in the jaw with a shoulder, and I was dizzy on the ice. Once I fell and hit my head with somebody on my back, and I saw stars. I was in a car accident. I was ejected from the vehicle, and I was unconscious. The doctor at Boston University told me those are concussion. So when we went over my history, we thought I might have had maybe six concussions, and one was the car accident for sure, and then five during my career.
Right. And the results were relatively positive for you, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah, actually, Dr. Alasco was shocked at where I was. He was real happy where I was, and I know that. He couldn't believe where I was, I guess, cognitively, for someone my age who had the history I had. He said that helps too, because they want to figure out why. Like, why am I where I'm at and others are worse off? So it's pretty interesting. And to be part of it, if I can help out down the road. I mean, Bob Probert had the CTE, you know, Henry Rashad. Did he ever have a fight? I'm sure he's had maybe a couple, but he wasn't a fighter. He's a Hall of Fame hockey player. A lot of them come from dirty hits, from elbows to the head, shoulders to the head, you know, charging penalties up against the board, stuff like that. So,
yeah, I guess thinking about, you know, Bob Probert and now Chris Simon, you know, this is sort of part of your. This feels like it's sort of part of the Mount Rushmore of which you are a member, right? I mean, it might be a big one, but it's sort of this select group of guys who stood out as the enforcers, but also as good players over the years. And it feels like you've lost another one tonight. I'm just wondering, I mean, that must be tough no matter what. I mean, he's one of you, right?
Yeah, it's really sad. Believe me, I think about that with these guys. I mean, I was close to Bob Probert. We became close after hockey, and we did quite a few things together. And I really loved that guy. He's just an awesome human being, and just a fun guy. And yeah, he struggled with some things, there's no question about it. I want to keep Chris Simon's family certainly in my prayers, and it's terrible what happened to him. And I think of his children and his family, just how horrendous it must be to have to go on without their dad now. It's terrible.
Chris Nyland, thank you so much.
Ben, no problem.
Know what that music means? We're about to talk to a journalist in this country who's been doing some interesting work this week. And let's head to Winnipeg for this one, because a very high-profile case in that city was in front of the courts again this week for sentencing, a two-day sentencing hearing for a disgraced former football coach, which wrapped up today, actually. Kelsey McKay is waiting to hear his fate after pleading guilty to 9 counts of sexual assault and 2 counts of luring. McKay taught phys ed and coached football at both Churchill High School and Vincent Massey Collegiate for around 2 decades. He was accused by multiple people of grooming and sexual abuse that occurred in the 1990s and 2000s while the victims were teenagers. The Crown is asking for a sentence of 25 years. McKay's lawyer have asked for a sentence of 13 years and 3 months in prison. But what's been really quite striking about this week is just the victim impact statements, the testimony from his victims that was read out in court today, including from one from the grave, essentially. So a young man who unfortunately committed suicide a few years back, his testimony was read. It just gave you a full idea of the impact of these crimes and the impact that it's had on the community. Richard Clusier, again, is co-host of The News on CJOB in Winnipeg, which airs weekdays from 4 to 7 locally. He's also followed this case very closely. He was in the courtroom this week to hear some of those victim impact statements, and he joins me now. Richard, as always, thank you.
Ben, it's great to be with you. And, this is one of those cases that's a whole lot closer to me because my son played football for this coach for 3 years. And thankfully, not one of the victims, but knows some of the victims. I know some of the victims' families in all this. It has hit this smaller community of part of Winnipeg really hard, the greater football community as well. But as I think we'll kind of get out of this conversation, there's also a big national angle to this story, in the sense that when we've talked about these types of predators before, we've talked about the Graham James of the world and how little sentence that they ended up serving, and that we were talking about single digits behind bars. And now, in this case, the Crown had talked about a 54-year sentence and brought it down to the Canadian standard of 25. And even the defense is acknowledging that there needs to be a long penitentiary sentence here as a result of this. So while sometimes we talk about the lack of Canadian justice and the problems with our justice system, I think this is going to illustrate, finally, we're starting to take these types of crimes a whole lot seriouser in this country. And I think when the judge hands down his sentence in the next couple of weeks, I think we're looking, somewhere closer to a 20-year sentence or something like this.
Right. A reminder for those who won't know this case, because I think outside of Winnipeg, I hadn't heard much about it. Who was Kelsey McKay? Because he was more than just a football coach and a phys ed teacher. He was sort of the cornerstone of youth football in part of Winnipeg, at least.
Yeah, certainly was. And I think people are familiar with the University of Manitoba Bisons football team, the university team, and their head coach there, a guy by the name of Brian Dobie, and he is as shocked as anyone, but hasn't spoken publicly about his relationship with Kelsey McKay. Dobie started his career at Churchill High School. This is an inner city, kind of just outside of downtown school that built a program, and Dobie had hired Kelsey McKay. McKay was a successful athlete in his own right, and ended up being head coach of the Churchill Bulldogs as Dobie went on to his career in university athletics. And Kelsey McKay was able to build this program, build a reputation, certified not just in football, but basketball and handball, coached a provincial team. And when Vincent Massey, a more suburban high school, was looking at setting up its own program, and this was part of the era where high schools were really trying to come on to its own and establishing their own programs, Vincent Massey went out and recruited Kelsey to start a varsity and a junior varsity team. And he was heralded as the next best thing because he could build a championship team at Vincent Massey. And he did just that. He was given carte blanche. Ben, yeah. I remember with other parents fundraising for the team when he was coaching. And he was revered within the football community. And obviously, as we now know, deep, dark secrets. And he went to great lengths to cover those secrets up.
Yeah. How did they come to light ultimately? I was thinking of Jerry Sandusky, of course, at Penn State, right? Which was a huge story that would have been happening at roughly the same time. How did it begin to unravel then?
When Kelsey came to Vincent Massey, he had some students follow him. And this was not just weeks or months. This was years of sexual abuse. He would bring them to his place. He would text them constantly. He would show them pornography. He would ply them with alcohol. He would offer massages. And then as soon as some of these players told him to stop it, he would say, okay, no problem, and then continue to text over and over and over again. And back in 2016, there were a group of parents from Vincent Massey that complained to the school division. And the school division ordered McKay to take more courses, to take more respect in sport courses that are designed to, you're not supposed to meet players one-on-one. You're not supposed to text players. He took the course but didn't abide by it. The behaviors continued. And so there was another local case that came up regarding a high-profile hockey coach. And then the kids, the children, they were teenagers, but children, they started to talk to each other. And it was on the case, a hockey case that came forward, that the students, all friends, started to talk to each other. And then finally, they started coming forward and 2 years ago gave statements to police. And in the one case where the one individual who at age 34 died by suicide, he had really, really struggled. He was groomed. He had been assaulted over several years, many times. And his victim impact statement, really from the grave, it was based on an interview with Winnipeg police. He had told the police at the time about ODing six times, the spiral of drugs and alcohol, and that while he still liked Kelsey, he hated his actions, and that was still someone that just was connected to Kelsey. But to answer your question, finally, after everything that occurred over the years, these brave young men came forward. Many of them came forward and gave statements to police. And then it just quickly unraveled. And I remember the day that the charges were laid. And my son, who's in London, England, texted me and he said, "My God, Dad, you know, there were so many rumors going around, but I didn't realize it was this bad."
Yeah. And you went to court this week for many reasons, I suspect, but you were there for the first day of those victim impact statements as well. What was that like? What was it like to be in that room?
I sat about 5 meters behind Kelsey, and he was all dressed in black, no belt. He's still a thick man. He's a big man. Earlier today, I finally made eye contact with him outside the court. And there was no real response there. But, you know, I spoke with him many times. There was a parents' trip with the kids to California. Again, this was a high-profile team. So it was, I felt it personally important to be in the courtroom, but also to give voice to those victims and to the families. So often in media, we treat these cases as kind of routine, and I didn't want this to be routine. I want people to know and to account for this, because personally, journalistically, there's the Kelsey McKay story. There's the story about holding an individual accountable for his actions, and the courts will certainly do that. But as you unravel this, there were so many individuals, many of them quickly retired from the school division, that also, I think, need to account, that have been silent and may never say anything. But there are people that did not take action that I think still need to be heard and held accountable for. And that's kind of my feeling on this. I'm passionate about this because there's an opportunity here. And I think the judge has a real opportunity here to make a statement with this case. So while it's big here in Winnipeg, it may set precedents across this country to hold those people that do this to our children, to hold them accountable.
Yeah, in a position of trust, unlike any other, right? I mean, that's what came out through your earlier reporting that I was listening to from the first day of this, of the victim impact statements, the first day of the sentencing hearing. Again, though, thinking to some of the other cases, you know, there's always the stories about, well, who knew? Who knew when? That was the big thing at Penn State with Jerry Sandusky. Who knew? Who turned a blind eye to it, right? I mean, I don't know what the culture was like, but these are always the questions that come up. And of course, the sentencing. You mentioned Graham James earlier. This was something that was not, it was punished, but it was not heavily punished in the past. And just looking at even the defense asking for 13 years plus now, it looks like regardless, Kelsey McKay is going to serve a very long jail sentence when we find out exactly how long he's going to be in jail.
Yeah, and that will happen rather quickly here. He did address the court very briefly today to apologize. I'm not sure that apology will be accepted by anybody in the room. I'm still thinking about the man that passed away, and his sister gave testimony in a victim impact statement, and she is a teacher. And just how she said that as a teacher, as a coach, how Kelsey violated that trust. And, you know, it's a sacred trust that we trust our children to coaches and to educators on a daily basis. And how dare he do this? So I'll be fascinated to see what happens as a result of this. But the bigger picture here, based on this and other cases and recent case law, is that when it comes to sex offenders like this, we're not talking about jail terms of in the single digits. We're talking double digits. And while we'll never end this, I think obviously the signal that's going to be sent here is that if you do this, you are really going to be held accountable.
Mr. Bouvet and Mr. Ambrose are relieved and grateful. They've been waiting for this. I've been working on this for 2 years.
There you have it. This is an interesting case. My guest is Richard Cloutier. He's co-host of the news on CJOB in Winnipeg. And this is someone he interviewed today. Actually, you just heard from Bill Gange, who's the lawyer for two men who were switched at birth all the way back in 1955. And there's an apology coming for them. Richard, this is quite the story about how they managed to fight and get this apology. It's pretty exceptional. Tell me a bit about the case.
Well, it is fascinating. And, you know, I think there's been an era where we're fascinated about our family history. And in this case, one of the people's sisters decided to take a 23andMe DNA test that revealed that she had a brother in British Columbia. The two individuals here, Edward Ambrose and Richard Beauvais, they were born on the exact same day at the exact same hospital in a community north of Winnipeg, in Arbroath, Manitoba, in 1955. unbeknownst to them, the babies were sent home with the wrong families. And that error didn't come to light until that DNA test. And so the apology by the premier tomorrow is to acknowledge the historic wrong that went on here. And there's been other cases like this, but Ambrose and Beauvais, they grew up in different families, unaware of each other's existence. Beauvais was raised Métis, later moved to where you're broadcasting from in British Columbia, where he still lives, went to a residential day school, believing he had Métis, Cree, and French heritage. Whereas Ambrose grew up in a Ukrainian family here in Manitoba. Both men, incidentally, suffered parental loss early at a young age. Both spent time in foster care. And it wasn't until Ambrose's sister just decided, because you reach that age where you decide, I'm going to try one of these DNA tests, 23andMe. And it revealed, you know, through the testing that there was a brother in BC. And she reached out to Beauvais, did some digging, confirmed the DNA results. And then the Ambrose family reached out to the lawyer involved here in March of 2022. And that's where the litigation started. The previous government really wanted nothing to do with this. The new government under Wab Kanew has really taken a shine to this case, so much so that the premier is going to offer a formal apology tomorrow. The lawyer is also meeting with officials, and he has a number in mind as far as compensation is concerned. The lawyer's done other cases in Norway House and in Garden Hill First Nation. And this case makes you wonder how many other incidents are out there, not just in Manitoba, but across the country, related to all those, you know, 60s scoops that we saw in this country involving Indigenous people.
Yeah. It was interesting reading that part of the issue here for the government is that they didn't want to take responsibility, essentially saying that the hospital wasn't a provincial responsibility at the time, therefore we're not on the hook for this.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in our previous segment, we talked about people not stepping up and taking responsibility. And, so often, you know, leaders will look at history and say, well, you know, we're creatures of our times. And other leaders will say, no, a wrong was done here. And in the premier's case here, Wab Kanew, and there's high expectations on him for a whole variety of areas, including reconciliation. And I expect his apology to be part of that continuum of reconciliation that we're trying to see with Métis and with First Nations groups right across this province. And certainly tomorrow will be front and center. And again, you think of these two individuals, had they been sent home to the right families, what life would have been like for them, as opposed to, you know, the checkered lives they've lived here. I just can't imagine. And I'm sure there are many people listening to us tonight that have had instances where they've taken these tests and have discovered all sorts of things about their background they had no idea about.
Yeah. Perhaps nothing quite as dramatic as what you've just described.
No.
Richard, as always, thanks so much for your time. We'll be looking, obviously, watching out for the premier's apology tomorrow. It should be interesting.
It's great to talk to you, Ben. I love what you're doing every weeknight here across the country.
Let's talk about happiness this half hour. A bit of an elusive term, isn't it? On a scale of 1 to 10, here's a question for you, because this is how this report works. On a scale of 1 to 10, how happy would you say you are right now, with 10 being the highest, 1 being the lowest, and why? I think as good Canadians, we'll usually give ourselves something between a kind of a middling, right? As Leo, our tech producer, gave us a 6. That's a very Canadian sort of somewhere in the middle. You know, I'll give myself a B minus. But I think if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, Canada's generally seen as a pretty happy place. You'd be right if you thought that was true. We again placed in the top 20 in this annual World Happiness Report. What is it? It was launched back in 2012 to support the UN Sustainable Development Goals. It's based on data from U.S. market research company Gallup, which is analyzed by a global team, including a UBC professor emeritus who we'll talk to, that's now led by the University of Oxford in England. People in 143 countries and territories are asked to evaluate their life on a scale from 0 to 10, with 10 representing their best possible life. Results from the past 3 years are then averaged out to create this ranking. So Canada sits in 15th place out of 143. That is down 2 from the last time they did this. We're 1 ahead of Belgium, 1 behind Austria, and our overall contentment rating is about 6.9 on 10. So let's say 69-70%. Pretty decent. Pretty decent. Finland, as I was mentioning earlier, is on top for the 7th straight year. I don't know what the Finns are doing right, but they're the happiest. Again, they're on a long run at number one. They're ranking 7.7 on 10. So it's not a huge difference, but it's noticeable. Followed by a slew of Nordic countries, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Norway, all in the top 10. Australia is at number 10. But digging into the North American numbers reveals something counterintuitive. Traditionally, it was thought that people get less happy as they get older, especially into middle age, right? That you're sort of happy when you're young. Life gets tough when you're in your middle ages, and then you get happier when you retire. That's not the case at all right now, or at least not anymore, in Canada and the U.S. It turns out the kids, well, under 30, are not all right. Canada is down 2 spots from last year because younger people are way down in their rankings of overall optimism and happiness. If you take just the under 30s, Canada ranks 58th out of 143. 58th. Just 6.4 on 10 satisfaction. American under 30s are even gloomier at 62nd, which helped push the U.S. out of the overall top 20 for the very first time. Felix Chung is with the University of Toronto.
When one person is unhappy, that's an individual problem. But when the entire population is unhappy, in this case, when the entire youth population is unhappy, it's now no longer an individual problem, but rather a structural problem. And a structural problem requires structural solutions.
Indeed. Now, for people over 60, it's the opposite. Canada ranks 8th out of 143. The U.S. was 10th. So imagine that if you're under 30, you're 58th, and America 62nd. If you're over 60, 8th, 10th. It's a big, big difference. As I was mentioning, the findings are at odds with much previous research into well-being, which found that happiness was highest in childhood and early teens before falling to its lowest in middle age and then rising again around retirement. So what exactly is going on here? John Helliwell is Professor Emeritus of Economics at UBC, and he's editor of this World Happiness Report. John, welcome back. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
I suppose the top line of all this is that, at least in North America and parts of Western Europe, it seems like the kids are not all right. That seems to be the big finding of this.
It is the biggest change we've noticed is the decline in the last 12 years of the self-assessed life quality of those people under 30. And it isn't just the world, obviously, because it isn't happening in the rest of the world. It's quite specific to those countries. Indeed, it is happening much less in Quebec than in the rest of Canada. So it has to do something with the kind of English language news feed and reconstruction of past and present that are going through the minds and making young people feel less optimistic about the future and as yet less engaged in doing something about it.
Interesting. I mean, it certainly had an impact on Canada's overall happiness, as well as America's. America, the U.S. falling out of the top 20, Canada falling to 15. That was really the impact of that unhappiness amongst under 30s.
Yes, because both of them rank quite high for the happiness of the over 60s. Canada number 8 and the U.S. number 10.
And then if you look at the under 30s, I think the U.S. was 62 and Canada was down at 58.
In both cases, 50 or more ranks below.
What do you think? I mean, you mentioned it, touched on it briefly, but what's your suspicion of what's driving that?
Well, since I'm being encouraged by La Presse in Montreal to break out the findings in Quebec from the rest of the country, it's one more piece of evidence that suggests it's something that's media and information related. We've also checked... Heifeng Wang has checked the actual lives of the people we were interviewing 15 years ago and now, and they're very similar in all the other aspects of their life. And so it's more how they're looking at their lives rather than the particular lives they're leading. I guess there's a Canadian issue that has come up in previous interviews in Canada, that among the other things that are bothering young people, the housing affordability is probably looming larger for them, obviously, than for older people in the population. That's a real something on top of just something. It is your real circumstance that isn't measured in the surveys.
When you look at what where Canada sits in all this, then we're at 15th, which is pretty good. I mean, overall, I think people would be happy to be the 15th happiest place on the planet. The top 10 is sort of unmoved, as always. It's the Finlands and the Nordic nations that are always sort of in that top 5 to 7 positions. But tell me a bit about the Canadian findings, because it was interesting. We always assumed in the past that people got less happy as they got old, and now we're seeing a reverse of that.
Well, we found this right around the world. One of the special chapters we had is on India, and a first really big survey of people over 50 in India. And even within that over 50 population in India, which doesn't have such advanced social safety nets as to handle problems of the aging, people are happier every year as they get older. And that's a phenomenon we find more or less around the world. So we are puzzled by that, because after all, people are getting less healthy as they get older, and the health problems matter more to them. And they're having reported fewer social interactions with others at home, at work, at school, etc. And yet they report themselves more socially supported, less lonely, and happier. There's something called a positivity effect that some psychologists have discovered, that as people get older at some stage, around mid 50 or something, they stop seeking something else more material and say, I've got so many years left to live, and they rethink what life is all about. And as soon as you do that, of course, you say it's not about the material things, it's about my social environment. And they look closely at what they hear, and they say, I'm not going to look at that negative news, I'm going to focus on, spend more time attracted to the positive, because there's an underlying negativity bias that applies everywhere. It's built into us and has to be fought, because it ends up giving you a biased view of the world, unfairly biased view of the world. This positivity effect ends up offsetting that for older people, and it's probably going to be necessary to move that learning process back a few years, because the younger people today, their lack of optimism is not really given by lack of opportunities. It's because they've got an excessively pessimistic view about the goodness of the world around them. You can't blame them. It's a part newsfeed, and it's part feeling responsible.
Yeah. It was interesting to one of the big stories obviously emerging from this is that the U.S. is out of the top 20 for the first time, and again, driven by that pessimism amongst younger people. And what was interesting, of course, is that the U.S. economy seems, for all intents and purposes, doing very well. Unemployment is low. The pandemic has worked into this as well. But it was interesting to see the U.S. down at out of the top 20.
Well, it's as you can might imagine, having the launch. We've had 3 launches this year, one in London, one in Washington, and one in the Far East, that there's been a lot of U.S. media attention to this, because it's really a big change. And so it is getting a lot of attention, and deserves it, because if it is mainly a state of mind, and it's happened recently, right, this is, after all, change within 10 years, so nothing dramatic has happened to lives in the United States vis-a-vis lives in the rest of the world, except the anger that's building up in many respects of people rethinking their post-colonial experiences, a combination of guilt and anger about race relations, about gender equality and treatments. You go through a list of all the headlines, and most of them are somebody getting angry with somebody else about something that was or wasn't done. And it leads you, because most of these things are not under individuals' own control, so they feel kind of barraged by bad news. It may be more of that news in the United States and Canada than elsewhere. It's telling that in Quebec, the drop is much less. So it means it has to have something to do with the news that people are getting.
John Halliwell is with us, Professor Emeritus of Economics at UBC, editor of the World Happiness Report, which is out today. Canada sits 15th, down a bit because the kids in Canada under 30s are not a happy bunch these days. They rank 58th, Canada's 58th overall, lower than Greece, Guatemala, Moldova, El Salvador, and a slew of others. The Americans are even lower than that for under 30s at 62, meaning they've been pushed out of the top 20 overall. John, we were just about to talk about some of the impacts that could have, I guess, going into an election year in the U.S. or, you know, an election coming up in November 2025, an election in Canada, presumably, that the way a certain chunk of the population is feeling could have a real impact.
There are studies about people's happiness affecting their votes. Typically, people are unhappy, want to kick out the current government and elect something else. So, yes, that would make a difference. But of course, we're not sure the unhappiness relates to government, especially as opposed to life in general. So you can't bank too much. If you're the opposition, you can't bank too much on that youth population coming out in your favor because they're unhappy about their lives. But it'll play in for sure.
When looking at some of the interesting aspects here, we've seen an improvement in happiness in what would be considered the former Soviet bloc, which I found interesting.
That's been going on for a while. What's interesting now is this convergence process has gone on long enough that some of these smaller countries are passing some of their bigger Western equivalents. Hence, you have Lithuania, for example, and Croatia and Slovenia, all now above Germany. Germany, of course, is a mix of old East Germany and West Germany. I haven't gone back into the German data to see if the people in the former East Germany are now happier than the people in West Germany. I kind of doubt that, but we'll see. But that convergence has been going on. And for the young, it's more or less complete. For the old, there's still a 1 point gap on it. So it's a big gap in the average happiness of the people over 60 in the Central and Eastern Europe versus Western Europe. And so many of them are scarred by their past memories. Certainly that's true in the countries in the former Yugoslavia. The people in that age group bear very serious scars.
Tell me about the picture then that this paints of Canada and perhaps of North America broadly, because it's always interesting each and every year to see where we're at.
Well, because it's something happens so quickly and it's not traceable to any of the standard variables we use to explain the difference, in some sense, from a modeler's perspective, it's a puzzle. So we have to explain it. If, in fact, it has no underlying material cause, then it's obviously people overreacting to the news and underestimating the goodness of others. It hasn't turned off their ability and willingness to help others. One of the key points of this year's report is we've gone back and looked again at the post-COVID increase in benevolence that's happened all over the world, and asked, is that something that the younger generations are party to or not? So we separated the Gen Xers from the millennials and Gen Zs on one side and the boomers and their predecessors on the other. And we find that all of them stepped up in all countries, including the ones with declining youth happiness. And the increase was even more in for the millennials and the Gen Zs. So they have the ability to step up and help others. They've actually done it. And so if they're not happy about that, which it generally does make people happy to do that, then they've got something else in their mind. And if it's not related too deeply to the material facts of their life, then it's a question they probably need to go to a course or two and rethink some of the things about making for a happier life. Coming from my background, which is on the social determinants of well-being, I said, well, the first thing you do is start paying attention, more warm attention, more open attention to the people you meet every day. Create happy spaces, happy places. If you're unhappy, you tend to sort of shrink into yourself. So it often takes an effort to go outside your comfort zone and reach out beyond where you normally would and make friendly contacts, the waves and the smiles, and try it out. That'd be my suggestion to some of the unhappy young. Just try it out for a while. See what it looks like. Put that machine away. Take those earbuds out of your ears. Treat the people on your street scene, in your neighborhood, in your elevators, in their shared garbage facilities, as friends you haven't met yet, not as strangers taking your space.
Right. So some silver linings here, perhaps, because I think a lot of people will look at this and think, whoa, the kids are not happy, but there are some silver linings in this. It may be harder to explain than we usually attempt to do in forums such as this one.
That's certainly the case. And so it's one of those cases where everybody should look into their own lives, say, what extent is this true for me? And what can I do in my own life to make life better for the people I run across and help give them purpose by working with them to clean up something in the neighborhood or do something with their lives together to make lives better generally. And I don't want them to do it just because it'll make them feel better, but I can pretty well guarantee them that it will.
John, as always, thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
It was that they didn't implement all of the things that were needed for it to work properly here, such as shooting or smoking sites. Those implements were not in place, and so it hasn't worked.
There you have it. That's kind of the overall sentiment in Oregon right now, with America's first experiment with drug decriminalization of hard drugs has ended after more than 3.5 years of pretty painful results. And again, the overall sentiment towards it is probably pretty similar to what you just heard there. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has pledged to sign legislation repealing the principal elements of the ballot initiative known as Measure 110, with nearly 2/3 in the state saying they want it changed or scrapped. Now, that stands in stark contrast to 3.5 years ago, when the measure got nearly 60% support from voters allowing it to come into being. If you're in BC, you'll recognize the arguments for why it was put in place in the first place. Confronted with the opioid crisis and a spike in overdose deaths, the idea was to decriminalize possession of small amounts of hard drugs. So if you were found in possession, the replacement for criminal penalties was a $100 ticket in Oregon. That doesn't happen in BC, but in Oregon, a $100 ticket, with the fine waived if the person called a toll-free number for a health assessment with the aim of encouraging treatment. And millions that would be saved on not being poured into the criminal justice system would instead be spent on strengthening the system around providing help and treatment for those who needed it the most. The intentions were good. The problem was none of it worked. The tickets didn't work. No one called the hotline. Open drug use became even an even more common sight, especially in a city like Portland. Violent crime rose, break-ins rose, and the overdose deaths didn't go down. Now, that's not all the fault of decriminalization, but whatever benefits it was supposed to bring certainly weren't being seen, or not enough to prevent a wholesale change of attitude towards the idea. Here is State Senator, Majority Leader, Democrat Kate Lieber, speaking with ABC News.
I don't think it is fair to say that somehow ballot measure 110 caused what's happening. And I think fundamentally Oregon was really unprepared for the crisis that is fentanyl because of our lack of treatment options. And we just have to fundamentally think differently about how we attack that.
Indeed, we weren't ready. There's something you hear more often than not. Joining me now is Keith Humphreys. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. His book is called Addiction, A Very Short Introduction. And he's just co-authored an article in The Atlantic called Why Oregon's Drug Decriminalization Failed. Keith, thank you.
Really glad to be on the show.
Take me back, I guess, to November of 2020, because I think there was an awful lot of attention paid, not just across the U.S., but in Canada as well, as Oregon embarked upon what was seen as a pretty, well, brave, I guess, or at least groundbreaking experiment in decriminalization of possession of small amounts of hard drugs. What was the rationale behind the move from the get-go?
Well, you're right to call it a brave experiment, something that hadn't been done before, which was through the ballot initiative process. A group of activists put before the voters, what about if we just got rid of all criminal penalties for all drugs, not just cannabis, which had happened a long time ago? And the voters thought it was a good idea, and it passed quite handily. And the idea was that money would be available for health services, and there would be nudges to get people towards treatment. There was a ticketing scheme instead of any kind of criminal penalty that would direct people to a toll-free number where they could call and get connected to treatment services. And there would be a lot of new places for them to go. And unfortunately, none of that really panned out. They had tremendous trouble getting those dollars out, so the services weren't set up. Virtually everybody ignored the ticket and didn't call the line. And the overdose rate has very sadly gone up at a faster rate than in any state in the country.
Right. I mean, I think this happened because obviously British Columbia, not too far away, was going through many of the same things at the same time. I think people were genuinely concerned about just the scope and scale of the opioid crisis, of the overdose fatalities we were seeing, and felt like something had to be done. And decrim seemed like a decent move. But ultimately, it felt like it was might have been, in the Oregon case at least, it might have been, I wasn't sure if it was oversold, but there was something wrong with the messaging versus the reality of what was about to happen.
So part of this was it came through the ballot initiative process. So rather than a long, deliberative, careful, thought-out legislative process with a lot of public comment and people tinkering with it and experts being consulted, essentially an activist group wrote this themselves and presented it to the voters whole cloth. And it's clear in retrospect that they didn't really understand the state or how to run a big health bureaucracy, nor did they really seem to understand addiction very well. I think it was more driven by their perception, you know, a kind of libertarian understanding that it's just wrong to have any criminal penalties for drugs. Whether you believe that or not, there are still practical questions that weren't properly addressed, like, what do we do with, say, you know, you want to go take your kids to the park, but the park is now full of people using and selling drugs. What do you do in a decriminalized regime? Where do people go to get help? What if they don't want to get help, but they're using fentanyl and you're worried they're going to die? Those things hadn't been thought through to the level they should have been. And I think that's a big reason why this didn't work.
Yeah, because it was quite popular. I mean, the Measure 110, I think, got nearly 60% of support back in 2020.
Yeah, no, it's a remarkable reversal. You're right. It passed handily. It was not close. It was a high 50s in support. But, you know, after almost 3 years of living with it, polls showed that 2/3 of people then wanted some or all of it repealed. And interestingly, although it had been packaged in some way as a racial justice measure, opposition to it was strongest among voters of color. And so those things together, I think, helped persuade the legislature that they needed to step in and try something different.
Where did it go so wrong? Because I think a lot of stories began to emerge about, you know, open drug use in Portland specifically, but not exclusively. And that those who had perceived that this might help all of a sudden began to realize that it wasn't. And that in of itself, I mean, you mentioned, I think it was 64% wanted some or all of it repealed within a few years. That's an awfully quick turnaround.
Yeah. So a couple of things became evident very soon. So the first one was that, as I mentioned, they had this ticketing scheme. The idea was, you know, you would be written a ticket and say, you're using fentanyl on a park bench. You know, we don't want you to do that. And this ticket is $100 fine, but you don't have to pay it as long as you call this toll-free number, and then you'll get a health assessment, and, you know, teams are standing by to help you. And then that would be a route for people into services. Well, over 95% of people simply threw the ticket away. And in the spirit of Measure 110, there was no consequence for ignoring the ticket. As a result, they had all these staff sitting around waiting for calls that never came. And as we note in the Atlantic article, a team at The Economist estimated that they'd spent $7,000 per completed call because of
the
staff.
That's quite the stat.
Yeah, really, it's just sort of tapping their feet. Now, if you worked with people who are addicted, this wouldn't surprise you. You know, you couldn't imagine, if you understand addiction, somebody, say, sitting on that park bench saying, you know, I've lost my family, I've lost my job, I've lost my health, I've lost my self-respect, but wow, a ticket for $100, my eyes have been opened, I'm going to change. That's just trivial compared to what you've already given up. So that just didn't work at all. The second thing was that perhaps out of distrust of the existing bureaucracy, they set up their own new bureaucracy that was going to have people with a lot of lived experience and who would be sympathetic to different types of services. And they were given a lot of money with the idea that they would build services that people would access. And as they admitted themselves, and the Secretary of State of the state admitted, that was really disastrous. So even a year and a half in, they hadn't gotten a single grant out the door. So even if people had come in for those services, they weren't there. And so anybody who loved somebody who had an addiction who was seeking help was painfully aware of that very quickly in Oregon. Neighborhoods, I go up to Oregon every, 4 or 5 months or so. And I was just struck by like the decay of just neighborhood amenity, you know, the amount of crime, the amount of disorder, places that used to be safe that weren't safe, that also became very evident. Now, by the way, some of this was going to happen anyway, because, you know, fentanyl is a very potent drug, as all Canadians, I'm sure, have heard at this point. It had been spreading out west, so some of these problems would have been there, because we see some of these problems, for example, in California, where I live, but not to the same extent that happened in Oregon. And, you know, when you promise people a lot up front, you can't really be surprised that they get angry when things get a lot worse.
Right.
And that is where I think the voters ended up pretty quickly, as you say, thinking, let's try something else.
Right. So a misunderstanding of the way addicts react to their own addiction, a misunderstanding of how the bureaucracy in Oregon worked in the first place, and visible decay in social order. It's a terrible trio.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, very, very well said. And so and that's, you know, there was a lot of focus on the overdose rate, which was going up very fast. And, you know, arguments about how much of this was Measure 110, how much it was fentanyl. But when I was, you know, when I go to Oregon, it's actually, that's not what most people talk about, because most people, the average person, of course, doesn't track, even an epidemiologist, they're not reading overdose rates, but they are looking around their neighborhood and they see the changes. And if they love somebody who has a drug problem, they're acutely aware of that as well. And I think those kinds of experiences are probably what moved more people than studies of overdose rates.
Keith Humphreys is with us this half hour. He is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. He's just co-authored an article in The Atlantic called Why Oregon's Drug Decriminalization Failed. It has indeed, it was about to be reversed after just 3.5 years. They will recriminalize possession of small amounts of hard drugs after a real public backlash to what happened back in 2020. Keith, you mentioned this in the article as well. I mean, there are things that a lot of people were watching this, certainly in the U.S. BC is going through its own decriminalization test or experiment right now. We're about halfway through, not quite. But a lot of jurisdictions in the U.S. were watching to see what happened in Oregon. And you feel like this is going to chill this idea of decriminalization, at least in the short term.
Yeah, this is going to create a lot of caution, understandable caution. And anyone who wants to, you know, we would say, so turn the dial down to zero. So, you know, if you think of drug policy as, you know, we only have two choices. We can have a carceral, racialized war on drugs, or we can just do nothing and let everybody use everything everywhere. If you feel those are your choices, you're going to be dissuaded from the second option, because that's kind of what Oregon did. But I would hope most people would realize there's a lot of space between those two things, between what Oregon did and what might be sensible. And we certainly have states in the United States that could learn from the way Oregon was before Measure 110. I mean, you know, Oregon had decriminalized marijuana before any state in the country. They had the lowest rate of nonviolent offenders in prisons because they spend so much on deflection, trying to keep people out of the system. That's something a lot of states could copy, which is between those two extremes. And I hope as states look at this, they don't just think, okay, reform is just a bad idea. See what happened in Oregon. What should really conclude is, you know, giving up entirely is a bad idea, but we can all be smarter. We could use jails less. We could use our criminal justice system more intelligently and with more racial equity, and we could provide more health services and improve on what we have.
Yeah, I suppose the caveats in all this are it doesn't make a difference overnight. It doesn't necessarily lead to a reduction in overdose deaths. And if you're going to do it, you better have the system set up and everything in place and the bureaucracy on board to be able to provide the services, or it simply turns into a bit of a free-for-all, as we saw in Oregon.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about Portugal, because Portugal, of course, decriminalized drugs famously now, like 25 years ago. But they had a huge array of services for people. So it really wasn't a parallel situation, because Oregon was near dead last in the United States in accessibility of care for addiction. So, you know, there was nowhere else really for people to go. So doing it, you know, making sure you have the infrastructure before you start these things would obviously have been a smarter approach. You know, this is how I guess, if from the point of view of the people who pushed it, they felt maybe they had a unique opportunity and they had to do everything at once. I'm not sure. I wasn't part of those conversations. But I wouldn't make a change like this if I were another state or another country without a thoughtful plan and a sense that, you know, we're going to look at this over a period of years and, you know, carefully watch the whole way rather than just jerk the switch this way or that way in our drug policy.
Yeah, it often sets itself up for a lot of political attack too when this happens. I mean, I think that's where the chill comes in too, is that even in BC, it's opened itself up because it hasn't been a magic bullet, because it hasn't had an impact on overdose rates. If anything, they're going up. And there is this sense that, you know, there's a bit of lawlessness around this now, that it is a very easy thing to shut down for other politicians to attack very quickly and have it shut down because there is this backlash. I mean, I don't imagine in Oregon's case that letting it go on would have necessarily improved the situation.
I don't think so. And it's worth saying, you know, your Canadian listeners may not all know this, but Oregon is a very liberal state, you know, very, very consistently so. So it has not turned into a right-wing state as a result of this. But, you know, but then learning also is even people who are very progressively minded, eventually, you know, if their car gets broken into enough times, or you know, if more and more of what used to be shared public space is taken over by drug markets, that they will react to that. And you know, you can't really blame them. You know, I've spent, you know, 35 years of my life trying to help people who have problems with drugs and say they matter. And at the same time, people who don't use drugs matter too. And it's absolutely legitimate for people to want to be safe, to want their loved ones with addictions to be able to get care, to want their children to grow up and be healthy and avoid drugs to the absolute extent that they can. And that's sort of, those kinds of considerations are sometimes forgotten by people who just focus on people who are using drugs. And you can't do that because we're all in this together. And even if you don't agree with that as a principle, that's how democracy works. Everybody gets a vote. So making sure policy is responsive to everybody in the population is very important.
Yeah, it feels like sometimes the vast majority are stuck between this sort of, you know, tough on crime, you know, no leeway at all versus the absolutely everything to avoid stigma, which a lot of people just don't agree with.
We are, you know, as a species, when we are emotional, we reason if more simplistically. That's actually something that's been demonstrated in a lot of, you know, psychological experiments. And we have intense emotion about this issue for very good reasons. We've lost people, sometimes people that we love. That's very upsetting. There's crime. Sometimes there's violence. That is scary. It's also simply just sad and scarring to see what has become of some of our fellow citizens. As you walk down the street and see somebody who is, you know, folded over a garbage can because they're high on fentanyl. So all that emotion is there. And it's important to feel that. That's part of what makes us human. But then not to use that to make our rational, careful decisions, to make emotional decisions like, I'm so mad at this, let's just, you know, punish the heck out of all these people. Or it's wrong for us to do anything other than, you know, tell everybody to just back off and let our neighborhoods be turned over to drugs because, you know, any effort to do anything with police would be unfair or racist or whatever. Those are impulsive, understandable reactions, but those are not the reactions that we need to have in policy. Policy has to be thought through carefully, even when it's an emotionally volatile issue like drugs.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
She had a stroke, broke a bone in her neck, and she'd been lying in bed for 6 days with nothing but Tylenol.
How hard would you fight to make sure that your loved one is properly cared for?
We want justice! We want justice!
You had a loved one that suffered in long-term care. I kept hearing the same things over and over again. This is not a coincidence. It's something I really want to dig deep and discover.
Systemic failure across all the companies while they bring in record profits.
$1.1 billion in revenue, and they are locking up incontinence pads.
It puts all of the blame on the staff when they're a victim as much as the resident.
There is no law to report a medical facility for improper care.
Only one person to look after 40 people. Hurry up!
The residents needed more than what we were able to do.
Only going to take one smoking gun to blow this open.
That was some of a very gripping NFB documentary called Stolen Time. It profiles the work of a Toronto lawyer named Melissa Miller. She helps families fight negligence and elder abuse, mainly in the for-profit long-term care facility industry. It does not make for easy viewing, as you can imagine. I think a lot of us at the height of the pandemic had our eyes opened even wider to some of the issues within long-term care period, but specifically within for-profit long-term care. What it does make clear, though, is how for-profit long-term elder care is a very lucrative business, attracting all sorts of people, including a major Canadian pension fund. And they say, and while the bottom line often seems to come before concerns about the very people they're supposed to be taking care of, or at least that's what this documentary tries to get to the bottom of, it does expose as well chronic understaffing, neglect, abuse, the list goes on and on and on. One of the big questions here is, what makes it so profitable? Why is it allowed to operate the way that it does? Why don't we demand better care? What's wrong with the staffing? Why are staffing rules set up in such a way that they don't have enough flexibility in them to make sure that there's always enough staffing? These are some of the many questions that the filmmaker dives into. Oddly enough, a lot of the profitability is actually thanks to a steady stream of public money into for-profit private care. Helene Klodowski is a filmmaker. She's the director of Stolen Time, and she joins me now. Helene, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Oh, great to be with you.
This is, this is one of those subject matters that really was in the spotlight during the height of the pandemic. I gather, though, that this is something that you've been working on for quite some time.
Yes, the film really started just at the very beginning of the pandemic. A number of friends that I have, they either had parents or loved ones in long-term care. And so I was listening to their stories and they felt so unprotected for their loved ones. And then really just by chance, YouTube sent me a video of a press conference from, I think, 2018, 2019, where I saw Melissa Miller, a young lawyer, a personal injury lawyer, talk about her cases against three major corporations of long-term care. And Melissa is such a charismatic person. Right away, I knew somehow in my body, I knew that she would be the main character of my next film. Don't ask me how I knew this. I just knew. And I had the gumption to call her up even before I had any financing or institutional help and support from producers. I asked her if she would be in a film that I would direct about long-term care. And she said, as many modest, wonderful people do say, why me? But I did convince her. And then it wasn't too long after that, that Ina Fitchman of Intuitive Pictures and the National Film Board came on board as producers. And you know, we got into action together.
Yeah, I worked as a TV reporter for a long time, and I'll tell you, the moment you meet Melissa Miller in your film, you know that she's the protagonist. Like, you know that she's the right person to drive this story through, just because of her, the way she tries to navigate this very, very complicated system. Not only does she have these lawsuits that are sort of mass torts, but many, many others as well. She's sort of single-handedly trying to right what she sees as a great societal wrong.
Exactly. You name it. And this subject is a very, you know, let's face it, it is a very difficult subject because no one wants to think that they will end up in a bad long-term care situation or their loved ones. And so the challenge of the film was to give place to Melissa with all her passion and her sense of justice, but also to make a film that is very, in a sense, the feedback that I get is very moving. It's very beautiful that there's a lot of suspense. So we can be informed. We can find out what's going on really in these long-term care corporations and at the same time be carried away by a wonderful change maker and a very dynamic character.
It's interesting that as I guess in the early days of the pandemic, when all those horrific images were coming out of LTCs in Ontario and elsewhere, that people really woke up to what was happening, to just how thin, if there at all, the safety net was in these facilities.
You say it very well. And what's really interesting, what I discovered with Melissa, is that she has been taking on these cases, kind of last resort, for years prior to COVID, and many institutions, they just didn't believe her. And she felt very, very alone in taking these cases on and listening to, you know, new client after new client. But it was with COVID that people really started understanding what she was facing and in fact, came to believe her.
When you look at what it is you tried to document, because I think the way the film is structured is very interesting as well, because you sort of start with, here's the problem. Here's what's happening behind these doors. And I think that was the part that was, I mean, it's sometimes, even though you know it's happening and you read about it, it's hard to watch. It really is, Helene.
Yes, no, I understand that. And that's why we feel carried along in this journey by Melissa, who, you know, as we, I think we both agree, is a wonderful change maker who's trying to not only, you know, win her court cases against these very large corporate chains of long-term care, because, you know, Melissa is the first person to say that not all long-term care is bad, but, you know, she's not saying that out at all. It's in the structure of these long-term care corporations. And I think the film tries to inspire us to, as Canadians, to feel that we have a right to ask and to demand good care. Often people feel very isolated in what's happening with, you know, if their loved one is in long-term care and facing these systemic problems. But I think the film is saying, you know, it's not just you and you and you separated. It's all of us together that need to change the situation.
How did we get here? Because you also look into that. I think institutions, including pension funds, by the way, one in particular, PSP, all of a sudden people started to recognize that there was money in long-term care. And so much of the blame, and you point this out in the documentary beautifully, so much of the blame for what happens and what goes wrong in long-term care is always laid at the feet of the staff that are there without asking, well, why is it? Why are they run this way, right? In other words, you don't blame the players, you blame the management in a sports team, for instance. And a lot of the problem here you've figured out, or at least pointed to, is systemic. It's about profit. There is the problem.
Right. I think the film really tries to understand this conflict between good, reasonable care and profit. And from what I've documented in the film is that there is just a lot of money to be made in the elder care industry. There's a pipeline of public funds, and there are many companies and mechanisms that take advantage of these huge public funds and try and extract profit from that flow of money. And often it comes down to staff being paid less, having less time. There's less perhaps nutritious food for the residents. There's all kinds of sort of symptoms of this profit extraction. But it often comes down to the very people that we need so desperately to care for us. And, you know, I think for all of us who have cared for a child, a parent, a loved one, whoever, a neighbor, whoever it could be, we know how much time and effort and kindness, generosity it takes to really care for someone in a dignified way. And unless we care for the care workers, it's going to be very, very hard to deliver that dignified care to vulnerable people that we, as a country, as a nation, as a people, should aspire to. I mean, that's what Melissa believes to her core, and I've come to believe the very same thing, because it's a universal issue. None of us know if we might end up in a long-term care institution or someone that we love and care for, and someone that we love and want to protect. It's really, I think it's a value, taking care of the most vulnerable, that we need to share.
Helene Kladowski is with us this half hour. She is a filmmaker. Her film is called Stolen Time. It's a documentary that looks into the long-term care industry in this country, particularly as seen through the eyes mainly of an elder rights lawyer in Toronto named Melissa Miller, who launches a sort of a mass tort, a class action against three large for-profit long-term care providers in this country, but also just looks at the families and the impact that they go through. It also examines the for-profit nature of it, as well as the staff and much more. Helene, when you walked away from this movie, I mean, it doesn't end with hopelessness, but I think through every step you do realize that the deck is very much stacked in this case against those who would hope to make this better.
Yes, I agree with you, Ben. I understand, and I think Melissa understands, that there is a mountain to climb in terms of really turning things around. But I think, you know, knowledge is power. And I think as more and more people understand that there is this conflict between for-profit and care, I think we have a responsibility and will have such a sort of self-interest to call this out and ask our politicians. We can ask them, for example, do you believe that our public funding should be going to private companies that are going to make a profit for shareholders? Do you think our public pension plans should be invested in for-profit long-term care? These are some of the questions that we can ask ourselves and ask our politicians, because the proof is there. For-profit homes tend to have lower staffing levels, fewer registered nurses, lower wages, lower overall levels of care provided. And a lot of the scandals that we hear about are tied to homes where there's the highest amount of private equity or biggest profits. So I think all these alarm bells are going off for anyone who has experience with these. But I think the film, you know, it's not a film about statistics or, you know, a list of, you know, numbers per se. It's not that kind of film at all. I think what I'm hoping to share is that reasonable, dignified care is a human right for people of all ages. And when we find ourselves or our loved ones vulnerable and in need of care, we want to feel that that care is there and not used for profit.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely the building blocks of hope in there, because the people you speak to, whether it's the people who staff it, whether it's the families of people who have, you know, whose loved ones are in long-term care, who are there to do their part, the goodwill seems to be there. It just seems like the system isn't able to, I mean, and you can even understand, you know, people investing in long-term care because it can be profitable in the long run. It just feels like we need to set some guidelines around what that looks like. And it doesn't seem, you know, that governments are all too interested in kind of laying down the law and saying, sure, you can make money at this, but here's how much money you can make, and here's what we expect in terms of, you know, dignified and reasonable levels of care.
Right. What gave me a lot of hope are people like Melissa and other people who are in the film. Many people know about the work of Pat Armstrong, who's really been writing about this subject for decades and has all the facts and data behind her. There's just more and more people, especially as, well, I'm a baby boomer, but as the boomers grow older and find themselves confronted with, you know, what kind of care is going to be before me, I think there's more and more people speaking out and sort of less feeling guilty about asking for reasonable care. I think as Canadians, again, we have a sense that we have sort of a public medical system, but not everyone knows that long-term care is not part of the Canadian Health Act. So I think there's a sense of we need to inform ourselves and be inspired by these change makers. And I really do believe at the end of making the film, I just have a sense that Melissa is right, that she's at the beginning of this journey, but that, you know, together we can get there. I really do believe that.
Helene, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful speaking to you.
When thinking about those who helped win the Second World War over Nazi Germany for the Allies, the name Sefton Delmer probably doesn't spring to mind. Delmer was the head of special operations for the political warfare executive. He ran propaganda operations for the British against the Nazis, which, according to my next guest's latest book, included the creation of radio shows that were hosted by German refugees in Britain, many of them Jewish, many from the cabaret and sort of acting scene, broadcast to German soldiers on the front that sort of mimicked German broadcasts, although they clearly weren't. And this is where the propaganda part of this all gets very interesting. But it was a way, it was the way that they were crafted, those shows, the manner in which he countered Nazi propaganda with a unique style that stands out to Peter Pomerantsev. Pomerantsev is now a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the author of Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, and This is Not Propaganda. So for years, he's been researching modern propaganda, including during his time as a news reporter in both Russia and in Ukraine, where he was born. But for his latest book called How to Win an Information War, he reaches back some 80 years to the story of Delmer, a man he refers to as a forgotten genius. Why? Again, it was Delmer's ability to engage an audience that would immediately tune out any kind of preaching from the Allies about the power of democracy, instead knowing that propaganda is really about emotion and how to counteract it. You need to essentially appeal to the same emotions and give people reason and validation to act differently. Just how much of an impact his work had on the outcome of the Second World War is hard to measure. But what lessons could his work offer us now in a time of disinformation and encountering Russian propaganda in particular? Peter Pomerantsev's book is called How to Win an Information War, and he joins me now. Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Canadians, and I think for most people who've never heard of Sefton Delmer, this is a really interesting read because we like to think that propaganda is nothing new. And so you've gone back to perhaps one of the most influential moments in the propaganda wars to try to find someone that might be able to shine some light on where we go from here. Who was Sefton Delmer?
So Sefton Delmer was many things, which is sort of what the book is about. But he was, look, primarily, he was an incredibly famous journalist in the sort of largely in the first half of the 20th century. He was like a superstar foreign reporter, like a Tintin character, doing like, you know, reporting from war zones, the rise of Hitler, Spanish Civil War, where he traveled with Hemingway, the outbreak of the Second World War, the Cold War. But he was like Tintin meets Borat because his talent was for impersonation. And he was sort of put on different disguises in order to get stories. He disguised himself as the assistant to the head of the SS in order to get into a SS rally in the 1920s in Berlin. But actually, I focus on him during World War II, where he kind of left his journalism or left his ordinary journalism behind and became the head of covert propaganda for the British. With a mission to undermine and subvert Nazi propaganda in Europe and especially in Germany. He was bilingual. He'd actually spent his childhood in Germany. He was born in Germany. He spoke German before he spoke English. His dad was Australian-British when Australia was a dominion of Britain, but like Canada was. So he grew up in Berlin where his father was an academic. He spoke the language and he kind of knew the Germans inside out and used those skills to get under the skin of Nazi propaganda.
What's fascinating about him is that given his understanding, his tactics for trying to undermine Nazi propaganda were fascinating because it was a bit like watching judo, right? Using their words back against them.
Exactly. He wanted to sort of crawl inside the vulnerabilities of Nazi propaganda and kind of explode it from inside. But his most famous things were these sort of radio stations, which pretended to be Nazi stations, but then inserted lots of real and fact-based criticism of the Nazis. There were many purposes to them, but essentially to sort of like distance people from the Nazi party. But he did that with an understanding of the power of Nazi propaganda. He didn't believe in preaching about democracy. He didn't want to preach to the converted. He wanted to get out of you know, the pro-democracy echo chamber, and talk to ordinary Germans, ordinary soldiers. His shows were full of anger and vitriol and the real lives of soldiers on the front, all mixed in with, you know, what could sound like a normal Nazi station with speeches by Hitler and Goebbels, all that sort of fishy stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of, that was his approach.
It was interesting that some of the reasons that he understood fundamentally that propaganda and buying into it is about allowing yourself to have an identity, and that what his counter propaganda was, at least targeting German soldiers specifically, was about allowing them to have a different identity. And so he would tap into these things. I mean, one of the interesting things, there's a lot of pornography in it, but one of the interesting things you pointed out was that oftentimes, you know, it wasn't about the salaciousness of the pornography. It was about the fact that, for instance, high level commanders had butter around in their pornography, and therefore, what do you mean? It was sort of this idea that they were corrupt, right? And that they were impure. All these sort of, as you pointed out earlier, this intellectual judo against all the veneer that the Nazi Party had painted for itself.
So a lot of his, especially early shows, were all about corruption among Nazi officials. And the porn was, well, ostensibly there just to get viewers in, to kind of say the unsayable. I mean, he's broadcasting from 1941, and his radio stations are among the most popular in Germany. And he's sort of, you know, it's a time when people are either in love or in fear of the Nazi Party. And here's somebody, you know, ranting about how Nazi officials were using luxury products and orgies. And the orgies were there to kind of break taboos, but, you know, it was their use of luxury products in a time of rationing that was sort of the aim of the communication. I mean, what was very interesting is that, you know, even though Delmer started creating what we would probably call sock puppet media today, so, you know, he was actually, you know, these stations would claim to be inside Nazi Germany and being broadcast by angry soldiers or something. They were actually all in Bedfordshire in England. And, you know, the people acting on them were often sort of cabaret stars from the Berlin cabaret scene. Lots of Jews actually pretending to be Nazis in order to subvert the Nazis, which is quite an interesting moment. But if at the start of the war, you know, he was trying to pass these off as genuine stations from 1943, and definitely when he's doing his biggest projects, he wants the listeners to know that these are the British cosplaying Nazis. And he wants them to know that the British know they know. And what he's really doing, and he talks about this in his memoirs and his colleagues write about this, is creating a kind of a safe space, a masquerade under which you could say the unsayable and speak the truth. I find that a fascinating idea. Yeah, he's not doing deception in the way that, I don't know, you know, Russia these days creates sort of like fake Twitter accounts to sort of, which are meant to be Americans or Canadians, but they're actually Russians. He was actually doing this in a way where the listener was meant to be in on the game, but it was safer for them because, you know, that way if the Gestapo discovered them, they could say, well, I thought this was a real Nazi station.
It's always hard to know what kind of impact that has on a war of that size. But you point out some specific examples where there were surrenders that were based on the broadcast that they were sending out. We don't know the full impact on the Second World War, but certainly it was not without its consequences.
So the British did surveys of POWs, and around 40% of them listened to these stations. That's a huge amount. The Nazis themselves complained that the radio stations were among the top three listened to in big cities like Munich. That's huge. That's, you know, imagine.
It would be enviable today, Peter. Be enviable today.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's less stations then, so it's harder today anyway, but there's just more media today, full stop. But so we know that they were listened to, and that's already a huge deal, especially if you take into account these were new stations. There's also like the BBC, which was very, very famous. Yeah? These were new stations, so no brand recognition. And Germans understood that this was the enemy broadcasting them. So, you know, today we complain how hard it is to penetrate, you know, through political partisanship, how hard it is to get people on the other side of the ideological spectrum to listen to liberal media, for example. And Delmer was managing to break through. He was managing to make content that was so interesting and relevant and spoke to audiences that he could break through a real war, not just a culture war. So that's already a huge achievement. In terms of changing behaviors, which is really hard to define, yes, you have like all these anecdotes in the British archives, in the American Secret Service archives, about how people would surrender after having listened to the shows. Because the shows basically indicated that the British knew so much detail about people's lives and were got so good at kind of surgically undermining people's belief in their leadership that especially as the British started to, well, the Allies started to advance across Europe after D-Day, helped inspire, you know, whole units to surrender. One of the very few survivors of the military uprising against Hitler told the British, or told Delmer, that his shows had encouraged the leaders of the rebellion, the Valkyrie Rebellion, to rise up against Hitler at the end of the war, because they thought that if the British were producing shows that sort of took the side of the German soldier over the Nazi party, that they would back their rebellion. The head of the Nazi radio told Delmer in Nuremberg after the war that the shows had caused so much chaos among Nazi elites that, and the ones immediately around Hitler, that they'd sort of started arresting people, trying to look for who the leak was to give, who's giving Delmer so much juicy information. And so there was that kind of chaos and complication that was caused as well.
Peter Pomerantsev is with us this half hour. His new book is called How to Win an Information War. It is about the propagandist Sefton Delmer, who spoke German, spent a lot of time in Germany, and then wound up helping the British war effort during the Second World War through an ingenious amount of radio propaganda at the time. And we, you know, Sir Peter's dug into him in this book. Peter, looking at today, I mean, I suppose we could apply this to many different forms of propaganda today, but one that you know particularly well, having been born in Kyiv, spent a lot of time in Russia, spent a lot of time in Ukraine. I suppose one of the most obvious now would be Moscow, would be Vladimir Putin. And how do you counter that propaganda using the Sefton Delmer strategies?
So look, firstly, Sefton Delmer has both positive and negatives. I mean, in the book, he's a, you know, a man of light and great darkness as well. So I do certainly don't recommend cutting and pasting what he did.
No.
But and there's negative things to learn. So as I said, Delmer created these kind of essentially what we would call fake news at the start of the war, which he would come to regret. His memoirs are this morality tale about how that boomeranged on him. But he managed to break through and reach audiences that, you know, didn't really want to listen to stuff from the enemy. He understood that the Nazis were tapping into people's resentments, envies, desire for superiority and cruelty and sadism by kind of exaggerating and flipping the propaganda. He was trying to, what he called, push it into the ridiculous. Not quite satire, because these were serious programs, but just alienate people from them. I mean, But I think we can take examples from more recent times. I don't know if in Canada you follow American politics, but there was a senator from Alabama, Senator Britt, that was on TV the other day, and she's a sort of a pro-Trump senator. And she was giving the reply to Joe Biden's State of the Union address. By overacting, she wasn't trying to be satirical, by overacting, there was this weird moment when even MAGA fans were stumped. Because you could suddenly see the extent to which all the cliches of Trump propaganda were just that. They're cliches. Yeah, they're poses. And that's what Delmore's aiming for as well. By exaggerating the propaganda, he wanted people to kind of go, oh, whoa, this is actually all a little bit made up. And therefore, I don't have to be as committed to it. Yeah.
It was interesting. And one of the things that I found fascinating is that how you pointed out that in the Delmer case, that fact-checking, for instance, just the whole idea of fact-checking and countering it with the truth, that really wasn't what he was up to. He understood what the truth was, but that's not how you transmit it. That's not how you get buy-in from those who would rather not listen to it.
Well, yes, because you know, people will, and we know so we have so many studies showing it now, people will reject facts if they challenge their identity, if they challenge who they are. Delmer was a great believer in facts, but he wanted to pick the facts that meant something to people. And his theory was that, look, all propaganda, all communication maybe, taps into what people really want to do. Yeah, so the Nazis tapped into people's desire for cruelty, sadism, sometimes for heroism as well, in its own kind of very perverse way. He was trying to tap into people's desire to do other things, their desire to live if they were soldiers, to surrender, to defect, to think about themselves, to think about the other loyalties they had to the church, to other soldiers, to their family, and not to the Führer. He was delivering them facts that helped them to act in ways that were good for them and bad for the Nazis. So that could be very basic things like, you know, he'd give people manuals that would teach you how to fake illness and avoid going to the front. I mean, that's a very basic one, I guess. He would give all these stories about corruption and disloyalty among Nazi officials, not for people to be outraged by this, but for people to go, well, if the Nazi officials are doing this, I'm going to do this as well. He'd give stories about, I don't know, submarines being sabotaged to show how normal this was becoming, and kind of encouraging people to go, well, look, if you don't want to sail into the mid-Atlantic into a, you know, a death battle, why don't you sabotage your own boat? And so on and so forth. On a deeper level, I think he was really trying to get people to think and act for themselves, getting into a psychological game where, you know, you're tuning into a station that was pretending to be Nazi, but you knew was actually the British pretending to be Nazis, and they knew you knew. So just entering into that relationship as a kind of co-conspirator, in a way, was already getting you to unbend your mind and be more active. Well, everything that the Nazis wanted you to do was be the sort of passive player in their gruesome pageant. So he was, I think, an incredibly sophisticated understander of what draws people to propaganda, and also how communication isn't just about a propagandist waving a wand and people being spellbound, but it's actually this act of communal co-creation. You know, the audience listening to this right now is involved in an active process with the media, especially with your show, listening to this, to me, rattle on. And that's what Delmer was looking for. He wanted people to get involved themselves with his media, and thus to stimulate them to act independently, which would also help Britain in the war and damage the Nazis.
Peter, it's a fascinating book and a fascinating example, especially as we contend with it these days. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for giving me so much time. I really, really appreciate it, Ben.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.